Guess what I found?
What is it?
Laser pointer.
The battery, finally.
That is impressive.
It's called Look It Up Online and Find Out Where There Are Radio Shacks That Open at 9 a.m.
Are there many?
Daly City was not open at 9. Lakeshore was open at 9. And I was there at 9. Yes, I don't like looking at details on the computer because they're all, you know, fuzzy, and when I turn around, I can really sort of see things. So I warned people today was a full lecture. Look at the class, right? I mean, I gave you time off last Tuesday. This just means you ask a lot. I was just talking to Dr. Mann. You ask a lot of questions when the class doesn't show up. So they learn the hard way. Ce n'est pas ma faute. As they say in the biz. So actually, can't start yet. 2 seconds more, right? This is so easy. Actually, somebody lost a cell phone. Was there a person in this class? Because there's one more apparati upstairs in the department lost and found bin. Sort of interesting to see how much I've lectured on so far. This is only 2 classes, not 3. By the end of the semester, entire lectures for 2 whole classes will be on this little computer. So I have written down here, thanks to people in this class, that I'm going to rent, and my 94-year-old mother, who lived through all the union movements and knows everything about everything from what I'm talking about, we're going to watch The Cradle Will Rock together for Thanksgiving. So. I hope I can find it in the town she lives in. But.
Netflix.
What?
Netflix.
She doesn't have, you know, you need a computer to do Netflix?
Take it with you.
You think I do Netflix? I'd never leave the house then. I'd become a total complete geek. I have to do things to get me out of the house. So, can I start? Think it's okay? Today it was sort of interesting to look at the study guide for today because and the lecture, because actually a lot of the things we've talked about since the midterm are sort of, in a sense, coming together in this lecture. And in addition, it does underscore what I was talking about last Tuesday, which is pre-Hispanic influence in the artists in the Americas. And, you know, we did a lot of African the first half of the class, and we're sort of switching over to pre-Hispanic ethnographic material for this part of the class. I'm on page 18 of your study guide, and we're talking about Elizabeth Catlett. And Elizabeth Catlett was born in 1919, and she, did anybody know, in semester, she came to San Francisco. Does anybody know? She's quite elderly. Her beloved husband died just a few years ago, and as far as I know, she's still alive, you know, at last word.
1915 or anything? It says 1915 in the study.
And I have 1919. Who knows?
Which would you prefer?
I'll never ask you the birth date of an artist. It doesn't matter. It's just so you understand her sort of longevity that I do that, right? I can't imagine ever asking my students to memorize a birth date of an artist.
What page is that?
18. Elizabeth Catlett is one of the best known African American artists in both the United States and in Mexico. And she speaks from a position in her mature work of a black artist living in Mexico. And she's often quoted as saying, I take pride in my two peoples. So she considers Mexico as much of a heritage as her African-American heritage. although she did not move there, and I'll get the date in a moment, I think it was 1946 that she actually moved to Mexico. There are three kind of trajectories of influence in her life. One would be Howard University Art Department, so Diego Rivera material. It's something that you should know about just in terms of the history of the United States. But it was a program, the WPA is what it's known as. It was a program that FDR put through Congress during the Depression to give artists of all stripes employment. So I'm not talking just about the fine arts here. I'm talking a much broader, definition of the arts. And one way in which it impacts your lives is that many of the public murals that you see in the United States were originally commissioned during the WPA. So go to Coit Tower if you've never been. It would be fab. I sometimes put that in this course, the Coit Tower murals. Would say, if you're living in San Francisco and haven't seen them, pretend you're a tourist one day, find out when it's open and go visit them. Or even better, I love the ones at the Rincon Annex Post Office in downtown San Francisco. And again, you can just walk into the post office and see those murals. So that's the WPA project that she worked on. And then both in Chicago and New York City for Catlett. And the third influence would be the Taller de Grafica Popular. And hopefully I have written it down, but I don't know. Somebody said to me, Judith, you keep calling it the Taller and everybody's going to read it as the word taller. And it never occurred to me. When I was curating an exhibition recently, I would wonder what the taller was. So here it is on the third line down on page 18. Do you see it?
Yeah.
Taller de Grafica Popular. Taller means workshop in Spanish. So it's a workshop in Mexico City that I'll also introduce to you. So those are the three major influences. And in evaluating her work, you really have to consistently take those three entities into consideration. I do want to start with a little bit of biography and then work through the slides with the biography. It's very important. It's sort of interesting to me. There's been a movement in art history to never talk about an artist's biography. And I always wonder, how can you understand so many works of art and artists' careers if you don't know the world that they're in, or that the world that they come from? It's a huge movement in graduate schools in the United States. It's forgetting history again, having amnesia about history because we don't like our own history. So, Catlett's grandparents were slaves. So this is, and it was, she knew them also, so it was very important that she started out from that kind of environment, knowing that her grandparents were slaves, and her mother was widowed, moved to Washington, D.C., and although she was a certified teacher, could never find work because she was African American. So I think that right new all-black college, Howard University, that is starting this art department, and she thought that was too easy. So she applied to the Carnegie Institute in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, which is one of the top schools in the United States to this day. She made it through everything, except after her personal interview, she was rejected from admission because she was African American again. So one of the things that Catlett always talks about is the fact that in the North, we assume that the kinds of racial prejudices that we know about from quote unquote the South don't exist, and yet in the everyday lives of African Americans, they surely exist and impact their lives. So this is very much part of her consciousness as she's growing up, as she's becoming an adult. So she ended up at Howard University in Washington, D.C. And just to refresh your memory, boy, I'm going to get sick. I just can feel it. In Howard University Art Department was begun in 1921, so it was still pretty new, and it was the first art department at an all-black, historically black institution of higher learning in the United States. So she studied there from about 1933, more or less. Just again to remind you, people we've talked about, Alain Locke, Lois Mayu Jones, were both on the faculty there, and somebody who was mentioned in the film, who's very important, his history of art book is very important, a man by the name of James Porter. And at Howard University, she was also introduced to the murals of Diego Rivera. And there were lots of books about him and about the mural movement that were available, and she was very much influenced by these Mexicans at an early age. After graduating from Howard with a BA in 1938, she went to the University of Iowa to study with Grant Wood. Now, Grant Wood is sort of off of the spectrum of the history of art. Most of you, if you're going to take Art 506, would never have heard of him. He's considered a regionalist in United States history. He's probably one of the most important regionalists, and he had an art school and a utopian commune type established in Iowa. He does fabulous paintings and mural cycles about vernacular American whites, okay? And if you just have never heard of him, just Google him and see one or two, you know, of his paintings or his murals. But she specifically knew that Grant Wood was in the teaching in the art department in Iowa and went there. So I think that we'll look at a few of the early works, and then I'll go back to the biography. 39. So this was after the period at Howard, and right after, or in the sort of at the end of her MFA training at Iowa. But let's go back for a moment to Alain Locke, just to review it, because been a couple of lectures ago. Alain Locke was a professor of philosophy and the nation's first black Rhodes Scholar to England. And he led the movement for black artists to reclaim their ancestral heritage as a way of enriching their own artistic expression. He believed that there could be a bridge and there could be a connection between art production in Africa and art production in the United States among African Americans. And then she had to take his classes at Howard. The other person at Howard that I want to talk about a little bit more is James Porter, the art historian. He wrote a book that was published in 1943, but he was working on that book when she was at Howard, called Modern Negro Art. You actually saw a cover to the book, I think, in the film I showed you. It was mentioned and they showed you a cover to the book. And he suggested, because they kept in touch when she was at Iowa, that she start entering art contests. Some of them were all black art contests, but he suggested she start entering these contests so that she could become well known, because she had this obvious artistic in Chicago. And she entered, and I believe it is this piece. Sometimes it's really hard when you have five different books and each one says things a little bit differently. One source says marble. This piece is limestone. I believe that this is the piece. It's the, because I know she won the award for a mother and child sculpture. And this fits in. This was done in 1939. She won the award in 1940. And just because scale is so impossible when you're teaching with slides, this is 35 inches tall. Right, 3 feet, you know, more or less. Okay. So from the very beginning, as her first sort of official entree, her talent was realized, and she won an award. Here's another piece that she did. The original final piece is lost. And this is a model for that piece in terracotta. And it is 1940. And it's, again, another, this one's called Negro Mother and Child. But it's another one. So there's two mother and child pieces from her early career. One of them was this award in Chicago. So she in her career. So she begins to work on a WPA project. And in 1941, she met and married another WPA artist, and his name is Charles White. And I want, this is an early photograph of Charles White with a 1939 sketch of a WPA mural he was working on. I want to show you a couple of his works of art, just so you understand what people were doing during this period. This is a famous mural that he did, and I'm sorry that it's so small. I have to get it rescanned and did not have enough time. This is at the Hampton Institute in Virginia, which is, again, an all-black university in Virginia. This is the WPA mural that he did in 1943. And what it is the contribution of the American, of the Negro to American democracy. So all of the individuals in this mural, if I was totally educated in African American history, I would be able to name all of these individuals for you. I found these reproductions rather recently. This is his work called The Preacher of 1940. And I don't know if you can tell, but there's a lot of influence in his style from the Mexican muralists. The musculature, the aggressive, very much the way, especially Orozco, who we didn't study, did his large murals. So this is The Preacher of 1940, and this is Hear This of 1942. Again, I want to tell you the size because the style sort of contradicts the size in a sense. This is only 21 inches, okay? But they are large, right, in the true sense of the word. And then I'll show you this, which is 1943, and this is called Awaiting His Return. So it's Second World War. But I want to show you a couple things. The kind of flat surface and the angular treatment of the body and the faceted treatment of the elements on the canvas. This is very much influenced, again, by looking at Mexican art and Mexican pre-Hispanic sculpture. So just, in a sense, keep this in mind. So this is Charles White still. I'm going to show you this. This is Elizabeth Catlett's, one of her first known lithographs of 1946, the year she went to Mexico. And again, can you see the faceted treatment of the surface of this painting? So let me catch you up now to their move to Mexico. They both, Charles White and Elizabeth Catlett, moved very politically involved at this point also. Let me remind you of Augustus Savage, who I talked about before. I said things would come together in this lecture. Augustus Savage, who I talked about before, who died a pauper because she spent most of her life running sort of community schools in Harlem instead of concentrating on selling her art. She started the Harlem Community Art Center in 1937. And then she and other people involved moved to the Carver School. Okay? So this is now the 1940s, and there are certain political events that are happening in the United States. I think what you have to know about is HUAC, the House of Un-American Activities, right? The House of Un-American Activities Committee. Everybody called it HUAC. How many of you already know about HUAC? Not enough. Okay. So, This is the 1940s. This is Senator Joseph McCarthy. Maybe you've heard of the Hollywood 10, the blacklisted Hollywood 10, and didn't make that connection, okay? This is an era of forced trials. This is an that were televised. We have a fabulous film in that San Francisco State owns called Point of Order by Emil D'Antonio, if you know about these televised trials. And this was an era where you literally were called up before these committees, and you were asked if you were a communist, name something that was done a lot, and telling on your friends also. So what happened was that HUAC started investigating the all-black art schools in Harlem, because most of the teachers at these schools participated in what was called in those days progressive political events. And to disagree with what was called sort of academics of the moment, right, to start your own school was considered contrary to national policy. I actually went to a school called Little Red Schoolhouse in Greenwich Village, and the thing I was taught growing up was, psst, it really was red. So, I mean, this is sort of the same period. It still exists. It's a famous school in Greenwich Village in New York City. So, again, to show concern for the poor, to start community art projects, to have community action part of an art curriculum, which the Carver School had, that was all considered un-American. And so HUAC started investigating the people who taught there. The school never had enough money. It was always threatened with closure. It became sort of a hit for the HUAC committee. And luckily for Catlett, she had applied for a very special grant that she was awarded in 1945. She was awarded a grant it's called the Julius Rosenblatt Women. She got the grant renewed. The political situation became so rough in Harlem, and Charles White, you can see from, you know, his art also, that she and Charles White decided to go to Mexico City for a while and to study with the muralists, to study printmaking at the Taller that was so famous there. So they moved to Mexico City. So this lithograph that you're looking at on the screen is one of the first lithographs she did at the Taller de Gráfica Popular in Mexico City, okay, 1946. And I want to show you know, you've seen a lot of Uxmal, so today you're going to see other things. You're going to get back to Chacmool, too. But this is the style of face mask from a culture called Teotihuacan that she looked at a lot, and there was a lot of influence. She immediately started devouring books on pre-Hispanic art and to learn about, you know, the art of her new homeland. So this is the style of the carving of the cultures of Teotihuacan that were in all of the anthropology museums, the big anthropology museum in Mexico City. It was totally influential. So just to sort of introduce her to you now, so we've gotten her into Mexico. So this is, I have a series of photographs of her and her family from the 1980s. I just want to introduce you to her. She eventually becomes head of the sculpture department at the university, famous university in Mexico City. First woman sculpture department, and to have an elevated position. She's in her studio here there. Here's a picture of her in 1984. This is a picture of her with, she and Charles White got divorced. She met a man at the Taller. They got married, and they stayed married the rest of both of their lives. This is Elizabeth Catlett and Francisco Mora, M-O-R-A, who she met at the Taller, and they got married and had three male sons. And then this is her extended family, right? Three generations of Catlett Moras in Mexico City. So you just get some idea of her culture. This is just a portrait of the members of the Taller in 1944. So think back to the Diego Rivera material. This is a famous printmaking workshop, but it's got the name Popular, right, in the official title. So it's popular printmaking. It's the posada that we talked about when we talked about Diego Rivera, and in the film, you actually saw him and his broadside in the film on Diego Rivera. So it's that kind of printmaking, printmaking that is dedicated to the people, to popular culture, to Mexican history, etc. So this is just a photograph of some of the famous in 44, and it's part of it's talking about the good neighbor policy of FDR. So it's good neighbors, good friends. It's sort of trying to say that Mexico and the United States should become good neighbors and good friends. Here's another one. This is what is ACS?
This is.
Oh, this is the new order of the Nazis. Okay, this is the new order of the Nazis. So anti-fascism, anti-Nazis, also 1944. And then we see a reclining figure. This is this. So Catlett is moving to Mexico, and what I want to try to teach you now is how that move influenced her art. This is a piece from 1938, before she went to Mexico. It's a plaster cast reclining figure. Look at it carefully, because I'm going to show you a series of figures now. In the beginning, before she had children, she worked in sculpture. From the years sort of 1947 to 1956, when she was raising her family, she did only prints. And then afterwards, she went back to sculpture again. So I'm going to have to work around. I've grouped the slides together rather than straight chronology into. I've said to you before that she knew about Diego Rivera's work. She knew about Mexican work because in the WPA, the Mexicans were a model for WPA projects. So here's a figure from 1938. Here's a figure from 1959 that she did. This is cast stone. The other one was plaster. But do you see the relationships of these figures, right? It's that whole idea of the reclining figure, and I'm just showing you two so you can get this sort of genre into your head. This is a British artist by the name of Henry Moore. And this is his reclining figure of 1930. Now, I'm going to show you quite a few of a group of pieces that Henry Moore did. I might warn you that if you look at books on Elizabeth Catlett, they will not mention the connection to Henry Moore, because it steps outside of what is considered the legitimate story of Catlett's development. He's not African American, he's not Mexican, right? But what he had in common with the artist was being influenced by and inspired by pre-Hispanic Mexican art. So what I'm gonna try to do here is show you how 3 inches. You've seen this before. This is a better shot. I found a better one. You saw it on Tuesday. Remember I told you that there was a dish on the stomach, so at least you can see that dish now. But look at this chacmool. Chacmools were all over Mexican collections. They're all over Mayan sites. They're all over some central Mexican sites. They're collected. They're, you know, sort of iconically Mexican. And I'll just go backwards again, so if you don't believe me, you can see it again, okay? Here we have the Henry Moore. Here we have the Elizabeth Catlett. I'll go forward again. And here's another Henry Moore. So what I'm trying to say here is as an art historian, and you are art history students, it's very important to open your minds beyond that which is canonical, right? So what I'm doing right now is I'm deviating from a canonical story of Elizabeth Catlett. I'm not putting her down. I'm not saying her art is bad. I'm adding an element that I think the four most famous books about Catlett do not include. And that's the fact. She never, as far as I can tell, and I've tried to read, she never met Henry Moore. Henry Moore never went to Mexico. The inspiration was from publications, just like Frank Lloyd Wright. So there's this thread I'm trying to put into the course, right, to carry these things together. So this is Stone, reclining figure, 1929, Henry Moore. And Henry Moore, and he's a modernist. We don't have a history of sculpture course in this department ever. But so he's experimenting with his own forms. Look at this wooden reclining figure from 1935. Do you see how he's experimented off of the basic chalk mule form? And here's another one of 1945, 10 years later. And to even make it more interesting, this is a head that Henry Moore carved from alabaster in 1923. So we're back to the 20s. And I'd like you to compare it to another Teotihuacan head. So Henry Moore, as this very well publicized, very well known British sculptor, definitely pays homage to pre-Hispanic sculpture in his work. Here is his mother and child. You don't see it. Poor little kid is right here. Okay? Look at, for those of you who know sculpture, I'll just throw out the names Constantine Brancusi or Modigliani. If you know sculpture, I'll throw these names out for the history of, for those of you who are art history majors, right, to make all these connections. You don't have to memorize it. It's just something to munch on. But here you have the fact that he was so influenced by pre-Hispanic sculpture and that it really was, he used it as part of his artistic vocabulary. They don't deny it. You know, this is not something that I've invented. Here's a last Henry Moore, which is Head with Notch, 1937. So I'm staying at the early period here, and I'll just show you this famous hacha with a notch from, again, from the museum in Mexico City. So here we have a group of works that I am sure that Elizabeth Catlett knew about, because people in Mexico would have had the books about Henry Moore, especially if they were interested in artists who knew about pre-Hispanic art. So here we have, again, we'll take it to the influence of pre-Hispanic art on her work. As I said before, during the period when she was raising her children and working at the Taller, she became a printmaker. And she devoted these years, it's sort of 1947, this is 46, to about 1956 with prints. And she did these prints at the Taller. So they were part of her production at the Taller. She she got married to Mora in 1947. This is in her prints. She changes the direction of what the printmakers in Mexico City were doing, and all of them. So this is her, that idea of two people, right? She's doing these in Mexico. How do we know about them? I mean, here she is working in Mexico. She had to, eventually she was so harassed by both the United States authorities and the Mexican authorities that she finally just gave up her citizenship in the United States and took out Mexican citizenship. But in the very early 1960s, she still was an American citizen living in Mexico, married to a Mexican, and participating in what is considered left-wing politics. the United States refused to give her an entry visa. She never could come back home. She couldn't come back home to her own mother's funeral. She never could come back to get an art gallery. And there's a woman I want you to know of, Dr. Samela Lewis, the first African-American woman to earn a PhD in art history. And Dr. Samela Lewis took it upon herself to fly to Mexico and to bring back these prints and show them in exhibitions in the United States for about almost a 20-year period, when Elizabeth Catlett was never allowed to come back home, even though she still held an American passport, because she was doing left, she was associated with an alien. So it wasn't until about the 1970s, under the pressure from the Studio Museum in Harlem and famous artists and famous writers, that this undesirable alien status was rescinded and she could again come to the United States. So all of the work that I'm going to teach you about was brought to this country and published in this country because of the initial work of Dr. Samela Lewis, who wrote the first history of African American art after James Porter, by the way. So it's all kind of connected in here. And this is part of her Negro Woman series. Okay? Very interestingly, the first woman that she paid homage to in her Negro Woman series is Harriet Tubman. And this print is called Harriet. Okay? So if you know African American history and you see a print named Harriet, you know what it refers to. For those artists in the class, I want to show you. One of the hard things about teaching printmaking is that you can do what are called restripes. You can take the same plate and use it again 10 years later and add to it. So one of the challenges in studying Elizabeth Catlett over the years is trying to figure out which are restripes and which are the originals. Okay, I had help by a book that came out, but I have a couple of comparisons to help you understand this. This is 1946-47. It's 9 by 7 inches, simply called Harriet, named after Harriet Tubman. You can see this again. Here's 1946-47, and this is 1975. Do you see it? So you get, you know, it's the same thing, same theme, but two different strikes.
Are they also known as states? Because the prints changed?
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
But I had written down here, restrike 1975.
Okay.
So that's incorrect? You're a printmaker, obviously.
Yeah, we call them states. As once you change the plate at all, it's referred to as a state.
S-T-A-T-E?
Yeah.
Thank you. And the word restrike is not used?
I've never heard of that.
Okay, see, I've heard of that. Okay, I'll change it. Thank you very much. For those of you who don't know about Harriet Tubman, this is Harriet Tubman late in life. Harriet Tubman led slaves out of the South to the North. She was one of the most important and famous women who ran the underground, what is known as the Underground Railway. Okay, and she's just a miraculous human being who knew the roots and knew the stars. Remember the discussion I had about the stars in the Lois Mayu Jones painting also? Okay. So here she is here with a group of slaves she led to freedom. And I found this photograph is dated from either 1940 prints. Linoleum prints are really very, very inexpensive. So this is what she was trained to do at the taller in Mexico City. So they were doing linoleum prints for political purposes. And what Catlett does is, you know, change the subject matter to her own subject matter. But these are all the prints that she did in Mexico City in the 40s. So this is, the title of the print is I Have Special Reservations. Okay? I have always worked hard in America. This is all part of the Negro Woman series. This is the first series that she did.
I'm sorry, can you say the title one more time?
Yeah. I Have Always Worked Hard in America. 8 inches. 8.5 inches by 6 inches. My role, you don't really have to write it all out. My role, just look at it in a sense. My role has been important in the struggle to organize the unorganized. The themes are there, right? It's the themes that they were concerned about at the Taller. She's translated these themes into themes that work in the United States. So this is all 1946-47, that Negro Woman series. And then the name of it is I Am Sojourner Truth, I Fought for the Rights of Women as Well as Blacks. And I'm going to do a little bit on Sojourner Truth because I want you to know about her. Okay, so this is the catlet and this is the photograph of Sojourner Truth, 1864. So some of you probably know this. Sojourner Truth gave her famous Ain't I a Woman speech at the 1851 Women's Rights Convention in Akron, Ohio. The women's rights movement grew in large part out of the anti-slavery movement, which is true. No formal record of this speech exists, but there were many oral history interviews that were done about this speech because it just is infamous, to say the least. Okay, how whatever the exact words were, we're not sure. The Ain't I a Woman made a great impact at a convention, at this convention, and has become the classic speech, one of the classic speeches of women's rights. So this is, I'm going to read to you part of this report. Several ministers attended the second day of the Women's Rights Convention and were not shy in voicing their opinion of man's superiority over women. One claimed superior income. And slowly took off her sunbonnet. She was 6 foot tall, and she towered over the audience. She began to speak in a deep, resonant voice. Well, children, where there is so much racket, there must be something out of kilter. I think between the Negroes of the South and the women of the North, all this talking about rights, the white man will be in a fix pretty soon. But what's all this talking about? She points. That man over there says that women need to be helped into carriages and lifted over ditches and have to be the best place everywhere. Nobody helps me any best place. And ain't I a woman? Look at me, look at my arm. She bared her arm and flexed her muscles. I have plowed, I have planted, and I have gathered into barns, and no man could head me. And ain't I a woman? And I could work as much and eat as much as a man, and when I could get it, and tear the lash as well, and ain't I a woman? I have borne children and seen most of them sold into slavery, and when I cried out with a mother's grief, none but Jesus heard me, and ain't I a woman? So that's sort of the classic, hope you'll never forget it, the classic Ain't I a Woman speech. So this is Sojourner Truth, who, you know, so she does Harriet Tubman, and then she does Sojourner Truth. This kind of stark black and white line is sort of indicates, which kind of is not hidden by the style of your prints. Okay, so this is Sojourner Truth, 1864. So my reward has been between me and the rest of the land. Again, the same series, 46-47. And then one that I do believe that the De Young Museum finally bought it. Anybody remember seeing it at the De Young? It was for sale. It was here, and I'm pretty sure that the Dion has bought this finally. It was quite a commotion when they were asked if they wanted to buy it. There are two versions of it. I could not find the first version. Now, is restrike perhaps used when the plate does not change and just 10 years later you print over on the same plate? You printmakers?
I don't know because I've never heard the term restrike.
Okay. I think that's what it is because there are two versions of this. It's simply called the sharecropper. And it became her most famous piece. And in the 1970s, she did what I have written down as restrikes of it because it made a lot of money. She kept selling it. Okay, so this is the sharecropper. So those are the 1940s period when she really is working at 62, and she calls it racial integration in Cuba. That's a Cuban flag. If you've never seen a Cuban flag before. Okay, racial integration in Cuba. And then I want to show you what her husband was doing because it's about the oil industry. And he did a series of prints about when the Mexican government took over oil fields that were owned by multinational corporations, okay, and bought them. So this was, you know, his politics. There's Mora's print, and here's another one done by Mora. So she raises her children. She becomes very well known for her prints. She has multiple exhibitions in the United States, most of them sponsored by African-American institutions or curated by African-American curators. She has definitely a certain amount of success. And then after her children go to school and are out of the house, she begins to work in sculpture again because that was her first art, because I showed you those first pieces that she did. And so in the 1960s, in the later 1960s, she is employed by the National University in Mexico City. It's kind of, this was really scandalous in terms of Mexico to have an African-American woman being hired as the chair of the sculpture department in Mexico City, right? So the 1960s are Black Power, right? It's the movements in the United States about the rights of the African American and the Black Power movement. So, but she again dedicates this to women. So this is one of her pieces. It's 5'9". As you can see, it's carved out of cedar, and it's called Homage to My Young Black Sisters. You might know, no, you wouldn't know. The Olympics that were in Mexico City in 68, 67, I'm pretty close. There were 3 long-distance runners in these Olympics, and when 2 of them were African-American, I hope I've got it right, I see the photograph in my head, same years, right? When you know how they play the national anthems? So they're on the podium with their gold medals, right? And when they played the national anthem, they did this. And that was in Mexico City. So this gesture became, you know, an international gesture, sort of. So here you have Catlett's homage to the gesture and the meaning behind the gesture. And this is Homage to My Young Black Sisters. And I have a black and white that shows you both sides of it. You know how difficult it is when you teach sculpture that they don't tend to turn the piece around so you can see both sides of it. So this is taller than I am, and this is the back side of the hand. So you're just looking at both sides of the fist simultaneously. It's called Black Unity, also made out of walnut. It's 21 by 23 inches, so, you know, just under 2 feet. And it also dates to 1968. Black Woman Speaks, 1970. And you can really tell that She began to be very well known by 1970. This is now bronze. She's casting in bronze. And this is simply called Target. She also did a series of prints in the 1970s, again, totally dedicated to the African-American struggle. So I wanted to sort of end this with this series of prints. This is called Watts, Detroit, Washington, Newark. So major sites of African-American unrest. This one, I think, is really powerful, if you ask me. 1970, it's called The Torture of Mothers. No, these are all prints. She doesn't paint at all, just printmaking and sculpture. Yeah, so, yeah. And black is beautiful. And that is the panther pin that she has here. And she's taken some of her early faces from that early series I showed you and used it here. So she has, after she was allowed re-entry into the United States, she had an enormous series of exhibitions. By 1990, she was having really huge one-woman shows at major museums around the United States. And she also had, in the late 1990s, a huge traveling retrospective. Yeah?
After she came back and she started doing, you know...
She only visited here. She never...
Oh, she never came back?
To live? No. Okay. Absolutely never. She still lives in Mexico City, three generations.
I can ask if they kicked her out again.
No, they couldn't kick her out. I mean, at this point, you know, there's no more HUAC.
Yeah.
And she has Mexican citizenship. She's here on a visitor's visa when she comes to her shows. She comes to the opening of exhibitions. There's a television interview with her, etc. But Mexico City, she married Francisco Mora, and that was it. Mexico City was her home. And she is a Mexican citizen. She gave up her United States citizenship.
Have you ever tried to hit
the files? Have I what?
Have you ever tried to see any of the files?
Yeah. Well, you know about the John Lennon. There's,
yeah.
You have to wait until, what is the word?
Freedom of Information Act.
Right, but there's a word on the files that you're allowed to get. What?
Declassification.
Yeah, when certain files are declassified. I mean, I'm not John Lennon.
No.
But I'm saying... There have been recently very famous files that have been opened up, and we've learned a lot. As, you know, like the John Lennon file, I think, was the first one that really got an enormous amount of publicity.
Well, yeah, I mean, and that also one. I mean, it's just a certain amount of time you have to wait until.
I mean, my file's going to be boring. What's it going to say? You know, what's this is what she did in college, and this is what she did in graduate school, and she was signed this petition, and she's been to Cuba 15 times.
You don't think that's really cool just to have a file out on the FBI?
Actually, I wish you all had one.
You know, I'm trying to look up myself.
Right. I just, you know, to me, it just, maybe I'm a little bit blasé, I'm sorry, but... I just, you know, just to answer the question, no, she kept her Mexican citizenship for sure.
So while she was in Mexico, was there any work that was influenced by Mexico than all the events that happened in the U.S.?
Good question. I didn't put, I have a few. She has a young girl with a roboso on that is obviously a Mexican Indian. It's all about women still, okay? And I do know of some pieces that she did, especially in that period in the 40s when she was beginning to find a vocabulary. Her political situation in the United States and then her political situation in Mexico influencing her, and then her vocabulary becomes an African-American one because that's what she felt she could add to that in her artwork. So, yes, I have definitely seen some prints that have what we would call sort of a more Mexican subject matter, but they're not as well known. They don't get as published. You know, one of the problems of art history is if things don't get published, you don't get to put them into your course because, you know, you don't have photographs, etc. But that's a good question.
I just thought it was kind of interesting because she's in Mexico while all of this is happening. Some of the things that she's doing, her artwork is happening. So she's kind of getting it as second hand in the ways of media of what's going on.
And totally.
Yeah.
Because especially, you know, she didn't, did I say 1970 about when she was first? But there are people going down to Mexico City to see her all the time. And Samela Lewis, Dr. Lewis, started it. But she's a very important artist in the African-American community, so I'm sure there's, you know, lots of people are going down bringing her articles, bringing her books, whatever. But good question. Are there any other questions? You know, I can't seem to, toward the end here, I'm doing a major lecture, but I'm not gonna beat myself up if I don't let you out at the right time. So, yeah. University approved that statue. It's a pretty radical act to raise your fist during the playing of the national anthem. I actually was in Mexico that year. It was a pretty phenomenal. It was the same year as though you're too young, but maybe you know about this, the Chicago Democratic Convention. Mayor Daley in Chicago. So I remember being on a bus. I was doing an MA project, pre-Columbian architecture or something, and the bus driver started screaming, "Is there an American here today?" So I ran to the front of the bus. I said, you know, I couldn't imagine. He said, "Listen, look what's happening in your city, Chicago." And there was, that's when the army and everybody came in. 68 is a, you could do a whole course, I think, just about all the arts and all the events in the year 1968, Paris, Mexico, Chicago. Is that the same year that, oh, that's right. My sister was in the painting department here when she said an army marched through the halls. So with that note, why don't you have a wonderful vacation? One more tape recorder left. What's up, David? How could I miss it? Like? I was surprised. I don't talk like or dislike. I was very surprised. I wasn't expecting. I was expecting something more abstract, more experimental in terms of contemporary art. So I was surprised when I saw that. I never said like it.
Right.
But of course I saw it.
Have a good one.
Yeah, you too.
My shirt.
Oh, because you have all the pictures and everything?
Yeah.
I want to buy the whole thing when it's over.